So the series this year is called Fighting Cancer with Knowledge and Hope. Bonsoir mesdames et messieurs, mon nom est Nicole Beauchemin, je suis un professeur ici à l'Université McGill et au Centre de cancérologie Goodman. Vous êtes à la troisième session de nos public forums et ce soir, le savoir et l'espoir dans la lutte contre le cancer. We've organized a session tonight on good genes behaving badly. So, since many of you, I think, have been coming and hearing some of our lectures, you know that a lot of environmental factors, diet, exercise, the air we breathe, the genetic constitution that we have, all have something to do with the fact that some of us actually will develop some cancers. There's been a tremendous amount of new research findings that are leading, as you will see tonight, to great hopes, new therapies, but there's still a lot of work to be done. So for the Anglophones, because I said it in French, my name is Nicole Beauchemin. I've been moderating these forums for 3 years, I think, and I'm a professor here at the Goodman Cancer Research Center, and since they couldn't make up their minds, I'm also in biochemistry, medicine, and oncology. So I have four bosses. Our first speaker tonight is Dr. Patricia Tonin. Patricia and I were reminiscing, and we've known each other for 28 years. When she was a young postdoctoral fellow that had come back to do some research. And Patricia is essentially been working for a long time on genes that are very important in certain families and that predispose to development of breast cancer first, and then she switched a little bit and she's working and has worked on ovarian. Tonight, she's going to tell us about the new developments after 20 years of research in this field. So, it's my great pleasure to introduce Patricia and have her talk to you about these genes that are called BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Lifetime risk is among 70 women to age 80. And this is about
documented, perhaps in a lot of detail, a family history with many, many breast cancers. This was unusual because the cancer occurred in multiple generations. More than 24 women were documented in his family history, which then died of the disease. And he recognized back then that this is something unusual, this clustering. But he also recognized, and this is in the Indian country, that there was an unusual age of diagnosis of breast cancer in this particular family. They were very young, or younger than the average age. So he recognized that back then, that this is unusual. And it's suspected to this day that what he was actually describing was the family history of his wife's family. So what is he referring to? What is he describing? What's so different? Well, if you look here, you'll see two types of families. Men are indicated as squares, women circles. The connections between each generation refer to siblings here, to parents, grandparents. Those individuals in these particular categories that are highlighted in red are those that have cancer. So what he was describing is something like this, and what he was comparing it to is something like this, right beside it. So here we have a woman, these are sisters, both diagnosed with breast cancer, here at age 42, another one with two breast cancers at age 34 and 36, which have an unusual number of cancers in the family. And he compared this to what is normally seen, and that is a woman with breast cancer and no family history. And families like this, which are called palliative breast cancer, versus this, which is spontaneous or sporadic breast cancer, are clearly different. So women, these sisters here who aren't, don't have breast cancer, are they at increased risk because of their family history? Was it some environmental factor? What's going on? Families like this were reported in the medical literature by the late 1800s. And it was suspected even then that there must be something that's running in these families. Okay. Why is this unusual? And here is what I tried to illustrate, why this is unusual. If you look at this family history here, you'll see, again, all those cases of breast cancer in the family I showed you in the previous slide. But also what you can see right beside it is graph here, which gives you an estimate or the chance of developing breast cancer according to age. The first thing that you should see here is that as you get older, the chance of developing breast cancer increases. And many so-called adult cancers, such as breast, lung, prostate, are like this. As you age, the chance of developing breast cancer increases. So a woman who's 25 years old will have a 1 in 20,000 chance of developing the disease. And this is a lot lower than a woman who's 50 years old, who has a 1 in 50 chance of developing breast cancer, from a woman who's 85, who has a 1 in 9 chance of developing breast cancer. Okay? So now let's look at this family history, and you can see something interesting here. Not only do you see many cases of breast cancer, but you also see that there's not one diagnosis here. These are the ages, okay? Below the age of 50. So what is the chance of seeing all these cancers occurring in a family where the chance of developing breast cancer before age 50 is so low? So there must be something going on in this family, especially if you cannot attribute it to anything environmental. So again, it might be something genetic. But what's the first evidence to suggest that there was something genetic? This was accomplished by epidemiologists. And reports started appearing in the 1980s describing epidemiology, they said. This is where you survey hundreds and hundreds of people, ask questions, and then compare, for example, women that don't have cancer with those who do have breast cancer. And if you ask questions such as family history, what's the relationship of these individuals to you, what's their ages of diagnosis, you can analyze the data and you can come up with tables such as this. And so what you're seeing here is that, for example, if you're a woman and you have two first-degree relatives, such as a mother or a sister, that would be a first-degree relative, and they were diagnosed with breast cancer before the age of 50 years, your chance of developing breast cancer by age 80, it could be as high as 40%. Or as a woman with a first-degree relative, such as a mother, was diagnosed the risk that we saw here at the top of the graph. Or two secondary relatives, such as ants, okay? Your risk would be much lower. So it's clear that the closer those individuals are to you, the younger their ages of diagnosis, the higher the chance, or the higher your risk is for developing breast cancer. So what this means is that there's possibly a gene that could be inherited in these families that increase your risk. Now, the first genetic evidence to show that such a gene exists was published in 1990, okay, for families like this by Mary Claire King. She's in Southern California. She's a statistical geneticist mathematician, and she applied a lot of her statistical knowledge and mathematical knowledge to answer a question. And that is, she took DNA from blood samples from individuals who had a strong family history of breast cancer like this, particularly women who had young age of onset breast cancer. And then she performed genetic tests on these individuals, using markers that would allow you to distinguish where these markers came from, whether they came from the father or whether they came from the mother. And these markers are polymorphic, so you can distinguish them. They're given arbitrary numbers or letters. In this case, they were letters. And as you can see here, and I know this is funny, but if you look carefully here, all those women with breast cancer had what's called a number E mark, okay? But others do not have that. They inherit something else. They inherited the other gene, the good gene, okay? When you see something like this that's associated with disease, this genetic marker, one way to explain this is this genetic marker must be physically close to the gene of interest, okay? And so the whole piece of DNA, the marker plus the gene of interest, was then inherited and passed. So this provided the first evidence that it must be a gene, which was then named BRCA1 for the first breast cancer gene, and it was located on chromosome number 17. We had numerous chromosomes, and this is the one that had that particular genetic marker. And this established the race to find this gene. Then along came Stephen Nerov, who was completing his studies at the International Agency for Cancer Research in France, and he noticed something interesting. He took these genetic markers here, okay, which is the location of where we thought this gene was located, and he genotyped. In other words, he genetically analyzed families with breast cancer, and he noticed that the families that had not only young age of onset breast cancer, but ovarian cancer such as this, so here we have a woman with ovarian cancer age 5, another with two breast cancers and an ovarian cancer. He found that those same genetic markers that were successfully used to show evidence of genetic linkage here were also linked. And what does this mean? This means that whatever this gene is, not only increases risk to breast cancer and to breast cancer before the age of 50, so young age of onset breast cancer, but it also increases your risk to ovarian cancer as well. So we're looking for a breast and ovarian cancer predisposing gene. Stephen Nerov then moved to Montreal, set up a medical genetics unit at the Montreal General Hospital. He was opening his lab. He was looking for a postdoctoral fellow or another scientist to run his lab. I came along. I took up this offer. I knew nothing about genetics, but may as well start one at this point in time. And he said, Patricia, let's look for this BRCA1 gene. And because I didn't know any better, sure, why not? Okay. So I became part of a much larger team than just the two of us that included several other, two other major teams located in the United States that were among many groups around the world looking for this gene. And fortunately, we were successful enough to identify it, and we published the information in 1994. And how this was done was to generate a physical map of the human genome. We don't have resources that we have today. Today, we know a lot about the composition of the human genome. We know a lot about the gene.
So a physical map of bits and pieces was generated, and one of those bits and pieces shown by the map down here, which was generated by the group that I was part of, was used to clone, identify the gene, and the gene was identified because when it was sequenced for its nucleotide, which gives an idea of all the mutations, it showed that those individuals who had breast cancer or ovarian cancer from those families had a mutation which was different than what was seen in those individuals who did not, or the general population. So that's how we identified the gene. Since then, this particular gene has been used in genetic counseling and identifying those that are used to risk. But we knew quite early on between when the gene was identified, that even, or even before the gene was identified, that only some of these families, some of these breast and ovarian cancer families like this, and only some of the hereditary breast cancer families like this, were accounted for by germline mutations or mutation in BRCA1. So we had a suspicion early on that there must be other genes involved. And sure enough, by 1995, we were part of another group. We played a lesser role, but still an important one, in identifying this gene too, and it's called BRCA2, even though these two genes show very little relationship to each other. Okay? So as you can see here, both of these types of families, those with ovarian cancers and those without, but that share in common young age of onset breast cancer, could be due to mutations in either BRCA1 or BRCA2. And the proportion is actually quite different, but still we cannot attribute mutations one to the other, but either one of them had those mutations. And I'll come back to some of these empty spaces later in the talk. So where does this lead us? Well, since these genes were discovered in the mid-1990s, genetic analysis of the families and the individuals who have these mutations, we've learned a lot. One is we confirmed that having a mutation does significantly increase your risk to young age of onset breast cancer and to ovarian cancer as well. We also know with some degree of confidence what these mutations mean. We know that genetic counseling can be provided. And we also know that you can reduce risk by developing these cancers by either removing normal breast tissue, called a mastectomy, or by removing normal ovarian tissue after childbearing years, called a uterectomy. So that data that was used, that was collected over the years by studying such family individuals, provided strong evidence in support of cancer detection or prevention strategies, and this information is here, but I won't go through it, but it is available. Okay, so now where are we? Post-1995, we are now not only able to determine which of these two sisters here in a different family, this is a breast ovarian cancer family, which of these two sisters here are at increased risk, whereas once we relied on those risk tables that I showed you earlier, which suggested, okay, you have a family history, two first-degree mothers with breast cancer before the age of 50, you have up to 48% risk. So now we have a genetic test to determine whether or not these women do indeed carry the bad gene or the bad copy of the gene, which increases the risk. And of these two sisters here, this individual does, this individual does not. This individual here, who carries the gene, will be offered cancer, breast cancer surveillance and prevention strategies, and ovarian cancer prevention strategies. It's her choice, but this is what she would be offered. The woman here who does not carry the mutation, her risk never goes down to zero, because there are other reasons that you could get breast cancer, but certainly she would probably not develop breast cancer due to genetic, this particular genetic marker. Just a little bit of information here, because the participants in many of the studies here in Montreal contributed to this knowledge. I'd just like to point out that in collaboration with Stephen Nayrod, early on when these genes were discovered, we soon came to learn that there were specific mutations that occur at a high frequency in very well-defined populations. So, for example, the Ashkenazi Jewish population of Eastern Europe have at least two BRCA1 and one BRCA2 mutation. This has allowed us to provide a very specific genetic test. And back then, over 10 years ago, this is important because it reduced the overall cost of genetic testing. Whereas the majority of individuals in the general population would have different mutations. It means this information should be relayed by qualified persons, such as a genetic counseling service, to interpret the results. Another population that I've studied extensively for the past over 10 years is the French-Canadian population in Quebec, and they too show a number of recurrent mutations that are present at a high frequency in the population, which is also allowed the development of a genetic test, and this kind of genetic test is also available in Montreal. So going back, we still have this gap to fill, and this is where we are right now with our research, and we hope to be able to fill it soon, but you can imagine since 1995, there have not been any major discoveries of new genes. The question is why? We'd like to know that too. One possibility is that the remaining families are due to chance clustering of cancers in these families. Another possibility that's more likely is that they're due to mutations in genes where they are more rarely involved in the population because there aren't as many carriers out there. And that's possibly what's coming. That's probably what's explaining this. So for example, there are a number of other genes. The palette or the panel of gene testing is now increasing ever more. There are many genes that confer increased risk of breast cancer. Many of these genes here on this particular list that are rarely involved in breast cancer are actually part of cancer syndromes that are very different than the cancer syndromes that I just described in breast ovarian for breast cancer. But they do indeed increase risk for breast cancer in women. And perhaps the reason why we focus so much time on BRCA1 and BRCA2 for breast cancer is that there are more carriers in the population, which could increase the risk. Okay? What you're looking at here is just a representation of what this means. So if you look at all breast cancers, how many of breast cancers, regardless of family history, could be due to the inheritance of a mutation? That's about 10% of BRCA1 and BRCA2. 1% are due to these other genes, and we still don't know what's going on with the other genes. Likewise, with ovarian cancer, there are many genes that confer increased risk to ovarian cancer, but perhaps we hear more about BRCA1 and BRCA2, or the more common forms of ovarian cancer, because there are more carriers in the population that have these mutations as opposed to other genes. These other genes that are implicated in ovarian cancer often also play a role, a more significant role, in colorectal disease. Thank you for your coming. Okay, because I'm almost done. So here's a representation of where we are in our studies with French Canadian women, but it's an example of what other groups worldwide are doing. They're trying to fill this gap here to try to explain what could be causing these other, the remaining families. Some with breast cancer are due to these genes. One is CALB2, which is where Dr. Faust has played a significant role in identifying not only this gene, but also recurrent gene mutations in the French Canadian population. For breast ovarian cancer families, we're also making some headway there as well. And this slide exemplifies some of where we are right now. All of these other genes up here, including the more recent one called RECQL, that was identified by Stephen Nerrett's group in Toronto, where both Will Fuchs led the group here, and I've also played a part in that, led to the discovery of a new gene, which we have still to study. It's not in clinic yet, but these are all the genes that might be and also a role in increasing risk to cancer. So what we think might be happening is that all these other genes that are coming up, each have a rare mutation because there are fewer people in the population that carry them. So you don't see the same effect as BRCA1/BRCA2. But for the person who carries that mutation, and for the families that have that mutation, it's very important. Okay, it's very, very important. So we certainly consider it important to know what these genes are, and we need to also establish what role they can play to reduce risk or identify the cancers at an early stage. So I'd like to conclude with this slide, which exemplifies the complicated slide, but I think it makes a very interesting point. I found it in a Nature Reviews. This is a journal that often publishes review articles, so I know it's difficult to read, but here it has a list of all possible cancer treatments, and here are little bubbles describing different types of some of the other genes that are on this graph here, they share something in common. They are all seem to be involved in their normal form when they are good genes. They're all, when they're behaving properly, they're all involved in repairing mistakes that are made in humans. So when your cells divide, and you know, they're dividing as we're sitting here listening to you now, when these cells divide, sometimes errors occur in the DNA, and these genes play a role in repairing some of these errors so that your other genes in the gene behave properly. Okay? So when these mutations have happened, and they happen in the cancer, we can take advantage of that information and develop cancer therapies to target them, to push the cancer to work down pathways which we know don't work with the idea of killing them. So where you see HR in this particular graph are areas where in which BRCA1, BRCA2, many of the other genes on the list are playing a role. So this explains why some of these therapies perhaps work better for women who might have mutations in these particular genes. And that's where the promise of new therapies are coming from today. And I'd like to end by acknowledging the hundreds of people that were involved identifying BRCA1 and BRCA2, not only the ones that were listed as co-authors of those papers, but all those individuals worldwide, and some of the members of my research group, some of my local members here, but more than anything else, none of this could possibly be possible without participants. Without the participants coming forward and giving their DNA and allowing us to go into their lives and collect information that we needed and put together these family histories, none of this would be possible. So that's how we'll come to that.
So thank you, Patricia. You were given cue cards when you registered. And so what we do is if you have any questions for the participants, we reserve some time at the end of the presentations, and we'll collect the cue cards with your questions written on the cue cards and proceed with answering as many questions as possible. So if you hear something and you want clarifications, make sure to write them down. The other thing before we just go on, I just want to make sure. This is the third of the forum of this year. We are heading towards preparing another year of such forums. And if there are topics that you would like us to organize a forum on for next year, you are being asked with the survey what you would like to hear. So please let us know. It takes us a while to recruit the community members that have special expertise in some of these cancers. So let us know, and we'll try as much as we can to answer your questions. So we switched two of the speakers because in the end it made more sense. And so Dr. Thomas Duchesne, who is the next speaker, is a colleague of ours who's laboratory is in the Dublin Cancer Research Center. Thomas did his PhD at the University of Montreal, the other side of the world. Then he went down to the United States and he ended up working in a field which was just beginning and has now become a hallmark of very important and significant participation in the development of cancer. He also ended up working in the laboratory of Greg Mello, who won the Nobel Prize for such discovery. And so we picked him up, brought him back, sent him up, his mice, his worms, his flies, and the whole animal shop. And so Thomas now is a member of our center, and he's going to speak to us tonight on Dicer mutations, from human tumors to model systems, and then back again. So you may see crawling things on the screen, but they're just on the screen. Thomas?
Thank you. my mom. The reason why I rehearse is because I often face the challenge of explaining the relevance and the importance of model systems. For example, it's not so easy to understand why one would fund public money into working on an earthworm to understand what cancer is. Now, my job tonight is to give you a flavor of history, really, and really remind you of the success stories and the foundations of what we know about cancer and where they came from. Because the vast majority of those findings, the foundations of what we know about cancer, come from those systems. So thanks, Mom. Can we really fight something we don't understand? Can we really amount a defense or a strategy or a logical strategy, something rational and long-term and efficient, if we don't understand cancer? The answer is obviously no. When Nixon in the 70s declared war on cancer, he didn't have the genome sequence. He didn't have all the information we know now. And he declared war on something he didn't know. Ended up sending a lot of money in there. Did a lot of great work though, but it was quite a challenge for something that he didn't understand about. Since the early 2000s now, we know just how complex cancer is. In fact, cancer is not one disease. There are many subtypes of cancer. Even if what we call breast cancer actually is composed of multiple subtypes, which have different behavior, different prognostics, and respond differently to therapies. So when you take a tumor bit and you sequence it, you sequence the genome information, small RNA, etc., what you see is a lot of genes gone bad. And you don't know which ones really matter. They're just accidents. You don't know which ones are, you know, bystanders, which ones contribute to a certain percentage of risk, or the ones that really drive the disease. So the challenge is to know, to discern really, which genes are responsible for cancer, that specific subtype, and how so, to mount a logical defense. Now, the best tool that we have nowadays, and we had those tools for a long time, to really tie a gene sequence to a function, to understand the function of a gene, are model systems. Now, you can sequence tumors and cancer cells, and you'll see mutations. But it's really difficult to actually go back. Ethically, it's not feasible to go back to the patient and actually ask in the patient, if you remove that gene or if you add it back, what does it do? It's an experiment. So you need a way to model those mutations and to tie an actual label of function to that gene to end up with knowledge about its function. That's the job of model systems. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can just go back and actually draw publication records. It's tremendously successful. That's actually where findings like basic findings in cell cycle, like the regulation of cell cycle, the cycle, cell cycle, goes, cells will go through a number of phases before they divide. They're all very finely tuned, finely controlled, and this is one of the things that goes above. A lot of the signaling, a lot of the basic principles of death were deciphered in mouse. We have a strong, this is one of our forte here in the GCRC, Morag and Nicole do wonderful work on cancer with mice. Zebrafish, even flies actually, have yielded fundamental knowledge that's directly relevant for things like metastasis. For example, I'm talking about the phantom mutant in zebrafish in recent years, where they look at pigmented cells, how they populate fish that is pigmentless. You can really see the populations of cells and the migration of cells. And it turns out the genes important for this are the same that are reactivated and going back in metastasis. So it really tells you how it works. Finally, the right of the street here in the star of my show is a nematode, a roundworm, about 1 millimeter long, really cute worm. And that's why it's called elegance, right? And we have a number of findings that actually are fundamental. Take programmed cell death, for example, apoptosis. Now, we just heard about chemotherapy. Chemotherapy, radiotherapy are essentially a way with a drug to activate program in cells to push them over the ledge and say, you should die. We're trying to activate a program of programmed cell death. in a tumor to say these cells should die. Now, when programmed cell death became a thing, where conceptually it emerged, it was discovered in the wild. It actually led to a novel prize, right, way back. So this worm and all those models actually were celebrated for different aspects that are actually fundamental and undissociable of our understanding of cancer. Now, I'm going to talk today about another such discovery, more recent, about tiny little nucleic acids that regulate functions very throughout the gene regulation systems. But the bottom line here is that model systems allow you to go from genes and formation to function in a matter to really amount knowledge about the function of genes in a rational manner, not correlations, direct causative relationships. Simply because you can't do that, those experiments in the human cell or humans, you need a model that will represent specific functions that are relevant. Now, the discovery of microRNAs was realized in the Nematode. Here you can see a video. I hope it's a rose view. For me, I love those things. But some of the folks might find them yucky. They're tiny, they're very cheap to work with, and they're extremely powerful, genetically speaking. They go through from oocyte to adult in about 2.5 days. Very rapid, so you can follow the genetics. They're hermaphrodites, so it's easy. You can freeze them, which is why people hate us for it. They're jealous because they need to flip and balance the male and female. They're hermaphrodites, so you make them there as well. Very powerful genetic model. And here are two of people I really work with when I was in Massachusetts, Victor and Rosalind Lee, husband and wife, actually co-published in the 1993 Foundation paper with Gary Rupert. Those guys are actually collaborators and competitors at the same time, and they drive each other to discovery. They discovered two microRNAs, one called LIN4, the other one called LIN7 in 1993, and that was the beginning. But the main finding about microRNAs is that a non-coding RNA, a small piece of nucleic acid, you see here, no dense. So microRNAs are tiny nucleic acids that go about and actually exert some sort of molecular acupuncture on gene regulation networks. They repress little nexus here and there and change the overall flow of information in cells. That's what they do. But how they were discovered was for a function called a heterochronic cascade. Heterochronic cascade comes from heterogeneous, chronic for time, and it tells you a little bit about their function. In the worm, those microRNAs were discovered essentially because they regulate the events of development. We think of development essentially as growing, more of the same stuff. But there's actually critical decisions taken at very specific moments in our development. Think of teenagehood, for example. You see that pretty kid growing up, growing very fast in all fridge, and eventually the hormones kick in, and all of a sudden there's hair everywhere. They don't want to show you their Facebook page because God knows what happened there. And all of a sudden they're aggressive, they want to, you know, they eat different things, and they behave completely differently. And they're really a different kind of beast, right? I know I have a kid that's 12 going through that phase now. So, but it really illustrates to you that there are programs, there are genetic programs in your genome that actually activate qualitatively different phases. And there are actually genes that are really cool, those interchronic genes that control those different. They turn on things, turn off things, so that you have specific phase expressed that's very specific moment in development. And that's the first function for microRNAs. Now, what are microRNAs? MicroRNAs are actually gene encoded. So in your genome now, in the human cells, there's about 2,000 microRNAs that are encoded in your genes. They're genes, but they're genes that regulate other genes. And the way they're born, essentially, is as a heritage. So there's a transcript of RNA, a nucleic acid polymer, that encodes two microRNAs. And this hairpin is a precursor and will be clipped by a protein called DICER. DICER will actually cleave twice. An analogy for DICER for tonight, I love this analogy, he's a lobster. He has two pinchers, right? So he can clip on both sides and liberate per precursor two microRNAs. Now those two microRNAs are very different, and we'll see why in a few minutes, right? But this protein here, the blob that you see behind the lobster, is DICER. And this protein is very important for the biogenesis and for those non-coding RNA to be born. What do? MicroRNAs are actually regulators. And the way they regulate gene expression is by base pairing. They go about in the gene in what's expressed in your genome
in the messenger RNAs, and it base pairs with the transcripts to shut them down.
Essentially, what it does is tone down gene expression.
Now, it doesn't do
that for all the genes in your genome. It's very specific.
And the way it finds its targets is to a region called the seed.
Think of a zip code, a unique address. Now,
each microRNA
has a unique zip code and looks about for all the transcripts of gene products and finds what the matching zip code. And so this gene now has to be turned down. Now, you can imagine for these events to be meaningful, that microRNAs are going to be very dynamic during this one. They're going to be turned on and shut down other genes. And at another later moment, this microRNA will go down and another microRNA will be turned on and shut down or another program. And that's going to be important for homeostasis and the progression of the events in development. Now, when it was discovered in 1993, people thought this is really cool, but it's probably something weird that happens. Now, you hear that for discoveries that were made in yeast, that were made in flies, that were made in a number of organisms, and never lies. Sooner or later, you find the same thing in human cells and mammalian cells, and people say, oh, maybe it matters after all. But this is just one other example of a fundamental discovery that took her some while to be recognized for its value.
When the genome was sequenced for other bugs, like humans and flies, we realized that microRNAs actually were encoded in all the genomes.
Not only could you find microRNAs in other genomes, but you could actually find the same microRNA sequence, the very same zip code, the very same structure and sequence in worms, in flies, and in humans.
So I don't know if it's what Nietzsche had in mind when he said that we had
still remnants of worms in us, but it certainly is true when it comes to microRNAs. So if the microRNA is conserved, if this event actually is this program of regulation happens in worms, it happens in humans, and it's important for gene regulation. One might ask, does it matter for cancer? Is cancer impinging on microRNAs? Is it exploiting this by selection, or is it breaking it down? And as I was at the bench there in Craig's lab in the beginning of 2000s, along came a paper from the group of Carlo Croce, famous molecular geneticist, who actually noticed that the microRNAs that were known back then, all those little arrows actually, correlated very closely with sites that are called fragile in the genome. Sections of the genomes that are often broken or amplified in cancer cells. So what this means essentially is that tumors actually select for microRNAs or delete them. It matters. It actually is a footprint of selective pressure for those loci. So in other words, I knew back then, we didn't know precisely what they were doing, but I knew back then that microRNAs mattered for cancer, and I decided to actually take a career out of it. Now, there was some evidence coming from the worm itself
in the developmental decisions that were reviewed by that 7. This is the lab of Frank Slack, did a lot of the early work on that 7. You noticed that
that 7 mutants for the microRNAs, where the microRNAs was lost,
cells of the V lineage, right, as you can see here,
keep dividing and fail to differentiate. Keep dividing, failing to differentiate. So it really rang the bell for him because he was actually aware of what happens in cancer. These are actually all marks of things that you commonly see in many forms of tumor.
So we hypothesized that the target of LET7,
what it represses, ought to be important for proliferation and differentiation.
And he discovered that LET7 controlled RAS. RAS is, I would say, the queen of proto-oncogenes,
discovered in a chicken, by the way,
right? And LET7 represses RAS, which is a proto-oncogene that,
when you talk about genes gone bad, that's one.
So LET7 is actually playing the role of a tumor suppressor in that context, in the world.
So then they started, through a collaboration, looking in human tumors,
and we soon realized that LET7 was downregulated in lung cancers, and that when you compare the tumor with the native tissue nearby, you could see that LET7 was lost very often. And you could see that RAS protein, that oncogene, that activated oncogene, in a tumor tissue, you have the inverted correlation. So LET7 was lost, RAS going up. LET7 lost, RAS going up.
So you really can see there that there's a smoking gun for tumor suppressor microRNA. And they went about to demonstrate formally that this was a bona fide tumor suppressor gene. Tiny little non-coding RNA acting as a key tumor suppressor gene. Now, one way to think about Micron is the puppeteer pulling strings on its puppets. Now, you might wonder, how much does it matter? You've got to imagine that there's about 2,000 microRNAs in the human genome. And each of these microRNAs, through its zip code, can target 10 to 100 targets. So when you really consider about 23 to 30,000 genes that we have, there's not much room left, actually. And microRNAs, from close or far, control pretty much every singular biological cascade in the gene. So it's not surprising that cancer broadly impinges on microRNAs and exploits others. It's a fundamental implication in cancer. MicroRNAs are misregulated. It's common. Now, when I joined McGill, I was introduced to a wonderful colleague here, Will, who will present last, by the way. And Will had been working on really peculiar tumors that happen in young children, atypical tumors, really. And those tumors are like PPD and cystic lymphoma, actually are cysts that happen in a bilateral manner, so both sides, in lungs, and filled with air, that were pretty bad because it made the lung collapse and provided a lot of sweat. It's very, very sad for those children. And cystic lymphoma also, you have a lot of cysts there in the children's kidneys, and that actually had a very irregular, very rare event to happen. And through a lot of digging through genomes, Will actually was able to tie those rare tumors and others, like in specific types of ovaria, to a mutation, a series of mutations that happen in Dicer. So now this series of mutations that happen are actually grouped together as Dicer mutations. Now, must ring a bell for you now. We just spoke about Dicer as the lobster, the enzyme that gives birth to microRNA, essentially, through this biogenesis process. Will found multiple mutations in Dicer. First mutation, and they all most of the time come with the same pattern. So there's a point mutation in one of the two genes, one of two copies, and the other mutation comes very specifically in the RNase 3B of the enzyme. So there's a blob here with domains of position and structure, but you have to just watch where the pinchers are. A and B are the actual two RNase 3 domains. And these mutations impair and affect only RNase 3B domain. So essentially, what happens is through mutation, you impair one of the two pinchers, and all of a sudden, Dicer can only give birth to one of the two arms of the three microRNAs. So, in accordance, because you only have one of the two microRNAs, only a subset of them can still find its target and repress them. So, de facto, what you have is a subset of genes being de-repressed in the Dicer syndrome. Now the big question and what we're addressing now is, which are those genes? What are the genes that matter ultimately in the Dicer syndrome? And which are the microRNAs that are affected? What would you do to know that? What would you do to actually go and understand how it works and which genes are responsible? Model systems, right? So the best way we have nowadays to model a disease like this in the model organism is a what we call genome edition. You might have heard about it because there's a lot of ink being spilled about that. It looks like a blob here, it's a bit complicated, but think of it as magic wand, really. Or a scalpel, because it allows you precisely to edit genomes. We're actually genome engineers nowadays. Without leaving any trace, you can go about designing a probe with CRISPR-Cas9 and modify a specific base in any genome. And you can do that in worms, you can do that in mouse, you can do that in flies, you can do it in human as well. There's very heavy ethical problems, and this is ongoing. It's very, very, it's fiery debate right now. But we can edit human genomes nowadays. I'm using it for model systems as a discovery tool, right? But it's just extremely powerful, and I think you need to know about it. And by the way, it was discovered in bacteria. So what I'm trying to do now is to edit the mutations that were discovered by Will in the Dicer syndrome into the worm Dicer gene. And I succeeded in doing that in the hotspots for mutation on HPV, but I'm also interested in other mutations that were observed in other portions of the protein. And because microRNAs function and microRNAs themselves are so tractable in the worm, much more tractable than anywhere else. I can actually look for developmental phenotypes, for gene changes in microbial maturation defects.
And rapidly, what I'm going to show you is some very, very puppy stove result that Ahinia saw actually got recently. This is an edit of mutations in Dicer. And what you can see here is that the positioning of Dicer, the pincher, the positioning of the pincher in that specific mutation changes.
And what this does, in effect, by changing the register, is actually changes the zip code address of the microRNA. So the microRNA that is born here through this mutation that was observed in the tumor is changing the address of the gene that is regulated. You'll find genes now regulated that were not regulated before. And you'll find genes that normally are regulated being deregressed. So this is just one of the early phases, and we're getting to more of those mutations, and that's something that we need to work more on. But what I want to close on, I'll skip through this, is the importance to stay really close to the clinical relevance. So we love those genes, we love how they work, it's really interesting. But what we're trying to embed here in a righteous circle is to have the clinical data, the mutations of patients, educate what we investigate in model systems. And in turn, we want to use the findings that we generate in model systems to make predictions, make hypotheses, and validate them back in patient samples. In that manner, we end up taking advantage of what we know about clinical samples, and we can make sense of them in a direct causative manner by modeling them in model organisms, not only in worms, in other species as well. But it's so efficient and fast and easy and cheap in worms, that's why we're having so much fun. So I want to end by thanking my group, this wonderful group of people to work with. Ahilia has left recently for Harvard, but there's good people in my lab that are taking the lead, Alexandra and Adam, at this year. Right? He's doing CRISPR. Yeah. So, and collaborators, Will, this great colleague plan, we're trying to find ways to recapitalize a maximum of those findings. And Mark is also working on the Abilene Davis program. Mark is actually working on the Dicer syndrome as well, using mouse systems, trying to model using mouse cells to really see how the Dicer mutation affects microRNA biogenesis. So on this, I'll thank you for your attention.
Our clinician tonight also has a little bit of a strange accent. You have the French accent, and now you're going to have the British accent. So Will Fuchs is a clinician, a medical geneticist, and he's a professor in the Department of Human Genetic and Oncology at McGill. He's the director of the program in cancer genetics. He runs around the city, and sometimes he's at the Jewish General Hospital, sometimes he's in the university, and sometimes we're not sure where he is. He's a great colleague to have around. He's been teaching our students about genetics for some time, and he paired up with Tamara, as Tamara mentioned, and has now sort of come up with this new Dicer mutation that, as you will see from his talk, but also from our patient testimonial, is so powerful and so important that it is worth investigating and continuing the investigation. So Thomas, as he said, is doing it in worms, and Thomas is my lab neighbor for some time. So you always wonder if these creatures skip the fence. And some people are doing it in mice. Will is actually taking care of the patients.
just give me that the slide? Stranger on the street, but there you go. It's probably a Mac to
a Mac to PC.
I'll read it from here. So curiouser and curiouser, cried Alice. She was so much surprised that for the moment she quite forgot how to speak good English. As you know, curiouser and curiouser isn't really a word. But the idea behind this was to show that sometimes these very curious, unusual tumours can actually be very, very enlightening. So just like to thank Tom for talking about Dyson from the sort of model system perspective. I'll talk about it from the clinical perspective. And I'll talk to you a bit about another very, very rare type of ovarian cancer that we've recently been working on with another person who's not here tonight, but that's Simon Quang. So it's rare ovarian cancers, what are they and why should we care, and recent investigations that we give. So I first of all want to point out people you can't see. Can we change this actually? It's not really that good at work. I mean it could work. Anyway, you recognize this guy here, but he's wearing a tie. This is Mark Fabian. If we can switch it. I think it's a Mac IBM. Sorry about this, guys. But it's, you have a Mac as well, though.
Yeah.
But you work for this work. Yeah. Sorry about this little technical pitch. Anyway, so the people I'd like to thank particularly Leora, who's on the right. So she's with the red hair. And Leanne, so Leora Rakowski, who's doing a PhD, and Leanne de Kock, and so really those two students did most of the work I'm talking about, which is great because without students you don't really have any research, and it's just tremendous how much work they've been able to do. So I think ovarian cancer could be split into three major types. Okay? So there's ovarian carcinoma, the type of tissue we're talking about, where BRCA1, can you hear me? Where BRCA1 and BRCA2 are the main thing we know. So ovarian cancer is split into three different major types. So there's ovarian carcinoma, the type that Patricia talked about, where BRCA1, BRCA2, and the Lynch syndrome genes. These are much the most important type in ovarian cancer. So sort of 90% of all ovarian cancers are that type. There's another type which are called sex called stromal tumors. They're much rarer. Nevertheless, interesting and important in their own way. And that's where the DICE story comes in. And the other type are so unusual that it's just miscellaneous. No one could actually find a good name for them. And that's where we find the other type of cancer I'm talking about, which is small cell cancer. So DICER, as you heard from Tom, DICER there are another group, and the miscellaneous group. So, epithelial bearing cancer, which you talk about, very, very important. The germ cell and the sexual stromal tumors are much more favorable prognosis, generally less affect younger women, but generally have a better outcome, and the miscellaneous group. We'll talk about it. So, there's particularly thanking to Tom and Mark Fabian, the picture I just showed you. So, really working with Tom on the worm side. So this again makes the split here. So here's the non-epithelial group coming from these cells here. You've got the oocyte, and you've got the left, the outer layer here. And so really this is where these tumors are thought to come from. Nobody quite knows where these tumors come from, but in general they're thought to come from that region there. Okay. So, and the genes we know about, we know it's got STK11, I'm not talking about today, but I am going to talk about DISA. So DISA, as you see here, DISA has interesting structure. It's really kind of technical, but the point is it has this interesting structure. You just need to remember it's interesting. So it's interesting. Why is it interesting? Well, it's interesting because, as Tom said, it does that measuring or cutting bit. That ends up being very, very interesting and very unusual. So taken from a picture that Tom actually drew, and you'll see here, again, you don't really understand this except look at the colors. Here's this 3B thing. That you need to remember that. And that's doing likely, if you likely, I'll keep Tom's analogy of the lobster claws. The lobster claws doing the cutting. And what actually happens is that you get this microRNA that is produced by the nucleus, the middle of the cell, and it has to get out of the nucleus, escape, so it gets out, it gets into the cytoplasm, and then it has to be cut into pieces, and that's why it's called DISA, because it cuts into pieces. And then it gets processed and does that bit that talked about where it is inhibiting, it sits on the message and closes down the message, turns off the message. It's called post-transcriptional gene silencing, but turns it off. Okay, how does it actually DISA? Again, simplistically, DISA sits on the pre-microRNA, cuts it, and leaves these pieces. And these pieces are then, as I say, loaded into that thing called the RISC, loaded in, and then so again, this is how it all works. And you can imagine that if you don't do this properly, as Tom indicated, you end up with problems. But nobody actually knew how this had anything to do with anything in humans. And you might say, well, if it affects everything, as Tom said, if you change all those 2,000 microRNA, surely, I mean, it's devastating. And we know that if you knock DISA out, when a person is one cell, animal. You knock out DISA, basically dies. So you think, well, obviously, it must be very serious the mutation in DISA. Well, it turns out that it is, but it isn't, which is very, very interesting, because you wouldn't think that you would start your career in cancer genetics looking at goiter. Because goiter, like, you can't get funding for goiter. I mean, who cares about goiter? I mean, let's face it, next one, please. So it turns out to be very, very frequent, but it turns out to be very, very interesting. I can actually spend the whole evening talking about goiter, but I won't, because you all want to go home. But this family might interest you, because it's quite an extraordinary story, thinking about families. So everybody in white has a goiter. You've never seen a family like that. I've never. This is the biggest goiter family in the entire world, ever published by anybody. First published at the Children's Hospital in 1986, followed up by Steve Nairn. Steve pops up everywhere, and then by me, and it ended up having a mutation in DISA. We were kind of stunned. We thought, well, surely that's not possible. DISA is really critical, but it turns out this mutation is very interesting because it doesn't actually stop the protein. It just changes it in a very subtle way. And Tom is going to help us look at why is it that this subtle change, one tiny position of DISA, makes such a difference? Because it's going to. So we thought at the time, okay, that's interesting. I don't need to tell you all about it. It's not that interesting, but to make the point that this mutation never been seen before by anyone, it's never been seen again. It's only ever been seen once in this family. Now, it affects a particular domain, it's not so important, but as ever, you think you're the first, in fact, you're not, because a very famous guy called Joe Frowley, who's still around, described a family with a renoblast. glioblastoma, which is an old name for a type of ovarian cancer, I'll talk about it in a minute, and thyroid adenoma, in other words, goiter. So you thought I was talking about ovarian tumors. So what's he talking about goiter? Well, there was a reason to it. There was, as Shakespeare said, method in his madness, because if you change the name, these are Sertoli latent subtumors, which are the sex-cord stromal tumors. And they have familial sex-cord stromal tumors and goiter. When you ever see familial, you think genetic. So when we saw this, we thought, well, maybe goiters and these rare sex-cord stromal tumors are linked. And here's a family with sex, what's called a Sertoli leading cell tumor, SLCT, a type of sex-cord stromal tumor of the ovary. And everybody in black has a goiter. So, ipso facto, this must be connected, and it has a Dyson mutation. So this was the first family we ever found, actually, with a Dyson mutation that had both the rare ovarian tumors and the goiter. Another family, and of course, if you look hard enough, you find another one, and this is what it looked like, growing here, quite a large tumor growing out to the pelvis of a young woman. And we then found collaborations with our friends in Vancouver. You have to have friends, but in fact, the mutations occur both in the tumor here, but also in the blood. So they're inherited mutations, inherit one mutation, then you get that famous 3B. Remember I talked about 3B, don't forget that. The mutations in the tumor are always in this 3B region. And you'll probably notice that all the numbers are actually kind of similar numbers. Here, they're not similar at all. Just look at the numbers, they're all different. These are all very close to each other. And that's because they map to this very, very important region that people have discovered. It's funny how science gets to me. You see things from different angles, you do a lot of reading. Sometimes a day in the library saves you a month in the lab. And in fact, they knew about this before, and they actually found that these two spots in humans were critical for the function of Dyson. And that's where the mutations are in cancers. So it's amazing, actually, that the science exactly gave the result that was predicted. And when Leanne just recently put together an updated version of Tom's table, that was from 2 years ago, this is from now, you'll see all the mutations in the tumors happen at these two spots. And all the mutations in the blood, in other words, that are carried and passed on in the family, scattered along here. This is a very, very unusual situation, never been seen before. It occurs in no other tumor type, no other gene. So they're specifically selecting for these weirder mutations. Is this of any relevance to anyone? Yes, I think it is, because here's a family from Western Australia. This girl comes to see us, and, well, she actually didn't see me, but they send me the story, and they say, what do you think of this, Will? She has a granulosa cell tumor and a goiter. And I say, well, it's not Dyson, because we've never seen a granulosa cell tumor in somebody with a Dyson mutation. And I said, well, let's send it anyway. So it turns out she has a Dyson mutation, both in the germline, shown here, and in the tumor. Actually, in the goiter as well. That's another story. So because of that, we said, well, that's interesting. I was wrong, I guess. You do get them in granulosa cell tumors. And I go, well, hang on a minute, let's get the package. So I send it to Colin Stewart, and he looks at this thing, and you know, I'm not a pathologist, you're not either, probably, but what I can tell you is that this thing here tells you that this is actually a Sertoli latent cell tumor. So she does not have a granulosa cell tumor, she has an SLCT, which makes perfect sense, because she has a Dyson mutation. So now you've changed the diagnosis, which, you know, actually doesn't matter a bit now. So you get the right diagnosis, you can help the family with dealing with the current situation. The girl's doing fine. She's living, I think, in Brisbane. This is an even rarer example of how you can use the Dyson testing. This is a tumor called an embryonal leptomyosarcoma, which is incredibly rare. So rare that most people have never even seen it, even if they're an ovarian pathologist. But it turns out they can occur in parts of the body, but they very, very occur in the ovary. Well, we sent this case from sick kids in Toronto, the other way around. Normally we send stuff to Toronto, they send it to us, and here it is here in ultrasound. She also had, as Tom mentioned, these funny tumors in the kidney, so we thought it was Dyson, and she also had a goiter, so we thought this must be Dyson, and it ended up that it was Dyson. She had a germline mutation, shown here, in other words, the one that could be inherited and passed on. And she also had a mutation in the actual tumor of the ovary, shown here. So again, all fitting. So this is the first report of this type of tumor. So if anyone sees another release, they'll know what to do. That's nice. So, it's a rare manifestation. And now we know, through the work of Leanne, who's an absolute powerhouse, so Leanne has basically gone through anything with the wood black silver in it and sequenced it. And what she's found is that this is the spectrum of dyson mutations. When I first spoke to you about goiter, it was goiter and a thing called glioblastoma. That was 2009, 2010. This is 2016. That's the list. So it's gone up a lot in 6 years. And a lot of the work's been done here by Leanne, but by also by other groups around the world. So again, once you start to find a gene, you start to do work in modern systems, you can really push ahead and make important insights. So, what about these miscellaneous genes? Okay, I've got 5 minutes. Okay, good. So, 10 minutes. So, small cell cancer glioblastoma. Most of you never heard of this condition because it's extremely rare. There's 400 cases reported in the literature. Patricia, mentioning to you there's 2,000 cases of ovarian cancer every year in Canada. There's 400 cases of this ever reported, ever. So you get a sense of how rare it is. It's probably less than 1 in 1,000 of all ovarian cancer. So, you know, you say, well, why am I talking about this? Again, you know, it's very, very rare. But actually, it tends to be very interesting, and it also tends to be very important that you have one of these genes because, as Deanna, I can see in the back, will tell you, it has an awful prognosis. These girls were diagnosed at average age of 24 years. First described in 1979 by a very, very famous pathologist called Bob Scully, probably the world's most famous pathologist, who died recently at age 92, still going to work 6 days a week. And he was a tremendous pathologist who described this and many other types of ovarian tumors. What they look like, again, if you're not a pathologist, doesn't mean much to me, but what you can say, I think, even without being a pathologist, is that there's that what you would call featureless. There's nothing to tell you where this comes from. You know, there's no bit of breast or bit of colon or bit of leg or whatever. It's just undifferentiated cells, as we call them. Okay, so what it turns, so we have a most common, it's rare, but amongst this particular undifferentiated group, it's not so rare. Very early age of onset, few cases, classified as miscellaneous, which means basically no one knows anything about it. And the differential diagnosis is very, very broad, includes a lot of even weirder tumors. So often pathologists don't know what this is and get the diagnosis wrong. The treatment is wrong. Surprise, surprise, no one's very happy. 5 years survival is only 30%, even if you have early stage disease. So it's really a disease that needs some investigation. The problem with the name, though, is of course some of the cells are actually going to be large cells, which is a weird name to call a small cell tumor. It's not really a carcinoma, which means an epithelial. And although I said it was called small cell cancer with a hypercalcemic type in the slides, in fact, hypercalcemia is not universal. This is a 15-year-old girl from CHEO, which is one of the hospitals in Children's Hospital of East Ontario in Ottawa, who presented in 2011 with abdominal pain. And normally, an 11-year-old with right lower quadrant pain, you know, it's probably sort of something related to her ovaries, a torsion or something. But ends up having the picture, it's awful, a huge tumor, and she ended up having a diagnosis of small cell cancer. Mother, interestingly, had a tumor that's rather related, may in fact be the same thing, because at that era, what was called a yolk sac tumor could be confused for small cell cancer. So we thought, well, maybe it's the same thing, really. We couldn't find, unfortunately, the pathologist had thrown the box away, and the family looks like this, and what we do now, with the help of Jacek Majewski, the genome center, we do a thing called whole exome sequencing, which basically is completely unbiased looking for the causes of them. Historically, you had to have those big pedigrees I showed you before with all the goiter, all the ones that Patricia showed, with many, many affected people. When you had lots of those pedigrees, you could find a gene using a mathematical technique called a log score. Now you can just simply say, where is the gene by analyzing a very small number of families. And this was essentially studied with essentially three families. Very, very rare, so you can imagine you don't get many families where you have two people with the same disease. Not only that, but it's often fatal. It's fatal, you don't have any children. So we were lucky in a sense that this woman had lived and had a daughter. And tragically, she ended up getting the same tumor. And we found a mutation in a gene called SMARCA4. And the name isn't important. And the pictures aren't really important. But what is important is the sense when we looked at other families, one, two, three, four, they all had mutations in the same gene. We asked, what's the chance of that? Very rare disease, mutations in the same gene. Well, obviously, it's the right gene. And we found that, in fact, all the families we looked at had mutations in the same gene. What was even more remarkable is when we looked at many, many cases, they all had mutations in the same gene, no matter whether they were familial or not. So this was a route into a rare disease by using even rarer examples. And what was fascinating to us, again, this is a bit technical, but just look at the picture. And I think all of you can see that this bit stands out. And okay, I colored it pink, so you can see it. Made it easy, right? even if you go a bit colorblind on me, and there'll be, you know, probably one person male, obviously, you can't see that because they're colorblind. You'll see there's a separation here, which isn't seen anywhere else. You see it? And what that basically means is that particular bit of DNA is missing. But what's really remarkable is the rest is completely normal. And that's very unusual for a gene. You hardly ever see it. Usually it's a complete jumble, like you've thrown everything out. It's a complete mess, up and down, up and down. I'll show you a picture of that later. It's called LOH. So, just to make the point, in summary, when we looked at many cases, we found mutations. The lollipop just means it's a mutation. Scattered along the gene, like with the dicing mutations, taking the gene out, in all of these. So basically, every case we've ever studied, it definitely is a small cell cancer, we find it's caused by small molecule. And, you know, what's interesting is that these proteins, again, don't look at the details, look at the big picture, is that these proteins turn up in these complexes that do many different things. So they're interchangeable functions. And that turns out to be very important because, even more weirdly, not only do these mutations cause these very, very rare ovarian cancers, but they also cause intellectual disability. Now, how do you make sense of that? Nobody can yet, but what's interesting is that the disability mutations tend to be mutations that change the protein but don't destroy it, whereas the cancer mutations here tend to actually kill the gene. So Coffin Siris is an intellectual disability and you have missense change the protein, whereas Scoot ends up being, well, small cell cancer, the ovary, ends up being the stops. So you'll see here, the very perceptive people will see it underline certain things. It says atypical pterygoid rhabdoid, it's a very long name, ATRT. You could say, well, what's the connection between ATRT, which is a brain tumor, and small cell cancer, the ovary? You could say, well, there's no connection. But you will notice from the previous slide that this gene here, SMARCB1, is the one that's usually involved. And you remember, so I'll quiz you later, that SMARCB1 is there. You see? So it's in the same complex as SMARCA4. Interesting. So we thought we made the incredible intellectual leap that maybe they were the same thing. Maybe they were similar. So this is work again of Jacek's team, without which we would have known very little. And Jacek looked at small cell cancer of the ovary in orange, in blue, brain tumors called ATRTs, and in red, ovarian carcinomas. And there's no prize for guessing which two look the most similar. And if anyone says red, they have to leave immediately. And the next slide makes it even more clear. This is that, remember that picture I showed you with all the colors are the same and just pink? Well, here, that's what ovarian carcinoma looks like, complete mess. Whereas the ATRTs and the small cell cancers just have that one spot. So they are actually quite similar. And if you do what's called a principal components analysis, big word, what it essentially means is, are they similar? These are ovarian carcinomas, these are small cell cancers, these are ATRTs. So they cluster, these cluster more closely together than these do. So again, maybe they are the same thing. Now, is that important? Well, we think it's important because if they are the same thing, then maybe the same treatments will work. And given the prognosis is awful, that's a good thing. So that's why we actually hooked up with Sid Wang, who's a brilliant, what we call functional genomics guy. He is currently upstairs working away. Actually, he's gone home. But anyway, he was upstairs. We can't be sure. But he was upstairs because we were just discussing a drug we have that works in cell lines and in tumors grown in mice model system. The same drug works in both tumors. I'm not telling you about this. But So the point to make is that we think these are rather similar. And also because we found the gene that causes these conditions, we can now offer genetic counseling to people with before we could do that. So that's a practical point aspect. So Nicole asked me to put a slide about what kind of what genes go with what diseases, and I'll just put this up here. We can come back to it later if you've got questions about, you know, do I need to test for this? Usually the answer is no. Sometimes it's yes. But make the point, rarer tumors might be rare, but the insights provided to biology may far exceed the bounds of their condition. And so I'll finish with three slides. Okay. Anybody know where this is? Well, you wouldn't, unless you from where I am from. This is Henry VIII. It's the only statue of Henry VIII in London. I didn't know that. This is the Henry VIII gate of St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, where I trained a very long time ago. But somebody trained there even longer ago than I did, and that's William Harvey, who probably is, after Pasteur, the most famous clinician scientist. And there's no one living who can contribute as much as he can, because he discovered the circulation. But he also wrote this in a letter to his friend. He used to write, it was written in Latin, of course, everybody wrote in Latin in those days. If you're educated, but we translated it into English. I won't read it out, but it's a beautiful statement of what it is that we do, Tom, Patricia, and myself. And for those of you who remember, who like movies, here's a treat for you. This is Bart's the Great, where they filmed the final wedding for Four Weddings and a Funeral. If you're in London, it's a wonderful built-in 1123. Thank you.
So now we come to the part of the evening that is always for everyone an inspiration. Will is a clinician, and so had the opportunity to discuss and treat a patient. And we've invited this patient to come and tell her story. Is Netta Robart and
Einhager.
Do you? You don't do
anything. I don't need it. Thank you. I was just introduced. My name is Netta Robart Einhager. Dr. William Folks, whom you all know, invited me to come today and share my story with you. My story began in 2009 when my oldest daughter, Lana, asked if both my sister and I would go to be tested to see if we were carriers of the BRAC gene. My daughter's need to know started when she found out that some of her friends had tested positive for the BRCA gene. These friends' mothers, who have similar backgrounds to ours, were victims of either breast or ovarian cancer. The similar backgrounds I am talking about is that we are Ashkenazi Jewish descent and have a family history of cancer. My mother, Chaya, which when translated from Hebrew means life, and oh how she wanted to live, died at the age of 42 of breast cancer. My sister, Helen, had breast cancer when she was in her early 30s, and thank God she's still with us. Since both she and I have children and grandchildren, Alana, my daughter, realized it was important to find out as much as possible about our family gene pool. At the beginning of 2010, my sister and I met with Laura Palma, genetic counselor, and Dr. William Folks, who heads up the genetic clinic at the Montreal General Hospital. We were scheduled to be tested for the BRCA gene not too long after that meeting. The results came back a few weeks later, and both my sister and I tested positive.
hysterectomy was scheduled several months later, in August of 2010. August came quickly. Before I knew it, it was time. And I remember lying on the bed, being prepped for surgery while waiting for the anesthesiologist, and thinking to myself, what the heck am I doing here? I have agreed to undergo surgery, and I'm not sick. I called Dr. Gilbert over and explained that I'd just come off a cold, and maybe there was mucus in my lungs, and maybe we should postpone the surgery. She was very patient with me. She called over the anesthesiologist, who listened to my lungs and reassured me that they sounded just fine. The surgery, which was performed laparoscopically, went well, and I was up and home the very next day with a follow-up appointment slip to meet with Dr. Gilbert 6 weeks later. 6 days later, I got a call from Dr. Gilbert's office asking if I could come and meet with her the very next day. Concerned, I asked both my sister and daughter to accompany me, and we were shocked to find out that Dr. Gilbert's extremely thorough pathologist discovered that I was at the very beginning of stage one of a very aggressive form of ovarian cancer. So much for the theory of, if it's not broken, why fix it? What came next was 6 months of chemotherapy, vigilant testing, and waiting for the magical word, remission. I'm here, remission. My younger daughter, who could not be here today, suggested that I share my feelings about what happened to me. And I have to be honest, I feel like I won the lottery. I feel thankful my daughter urged us to be tested, and more thankful both to my sister. Both I and my sister followed through with elective surgery. Had we not, I dread to think what the outcome could have been. Okay, I have a newspaper. This is an August 26, 2011 edition of the Montreal Gazette. I don't know if you can see it. The caption reads, "Rethinking Ovarian Cancer." When Netta Rothbart learned that she was predisposed to developing ovarian cancer, the number fourth cause of death among Canadian women, she fought back by opting to have her uterus removed and undergoing chemotherapy before the disease made her sick. Sorry. My chemo treatments ended in February 2011, and my last appointment with Dr. Gilbert was August 2011, not too long before this picture was taken. This picture depicts me listening to Dr. Gilbert's advice. I asked Dr. Gilbert, what was next? Her answer was, leave here and never come back. I'm sure if my mother was here, she would advise me to always listen to my daughter. I believe we can make success stories like mine and my sister's happen by being proactive, by self-awareness, consistent monitoring, getting the message out, research, fundraising, etc. I just need to say thank you.
And as Will mentioned, there's some things that we know clearly increase your risk of cancer, such as exposure to using the radiation. So if that's a difficult question to address, but yes, I think that all those factors probably do play a role, and we just don't know how much of it. Pfizer is responsible for microRNA processing and mutation in it will deregulate half the genome. Why is it that inherited Pfizer mutations are not embryonic?
It's actually part of what we're trying to figure out. But it's important to keep in mind that even though mutations in Pfizer will have a very broad individuals with the variation in the genetic makeup and in different environments, you can see a lot of fluctuation for messenger RNAs, for gene products, but also in microRNA. It's extremely sensitive to the environment. So they fluctuate normally and naturally anyway. What matters is probably a subset of those targets, a subset of those genes, a subset of those microRNAs. And when you use the 5P microRNAs by the RNA-3D, the phenotype of the disease is probably exactly where the cutoff is, where it matters, where you can see an effect of those things. It's not that there's not a lot of ripples in gene network downstream that we don't appreciate because we don't live in this way. It's simply that it doesn't need to exist in the phenotype. But the genetics partly answer this question, because if you look at the Pfizer syndrome, we only can see that one of the is normally a stop or nonsense mutation, whereas the other mutation is always discrete, precisely in the RNA-3D. So it won't sacrifice all the microRNAs. It's actually tone it down and remove just a subset of microRNAs. Let me see that.
Another question on Dicer. If it's germline mutation, what gives Dicer mutation tissue specificity?
Very good question.
What I described to you is
some successful stories with memories that are lost being restored. One of my favorite is actually I worked down my friend's back and successfully restored the 7 expressions. That's something that I use here, pinning off. He used a model to show that. So it's but because of the delivery system being available for a month by a certain aerosol, he essentially just delivered that 7 microarray by aerosol in a mouse that had lost the 7. And so that's one publication is now pretty showing that it works. So, but the lung is probably a low hanging fruit because you have other issues that are more difficult to where you try to replace my parts. And the challenge here is simple. It's not even something about specific delivery. Having the microRNA be like rich in amino acid, it's polar, it's unstable, being delivered specifically to patients. And for gene therapy, the same problem for CRISPR gene conditions are the same thing. We need ways to deliver amino acid in the lungs. Inhibitors or mimics and replacement, especially with patients. And people have been trying to do that for a long time. It's a big job.
So I just
want to
say that
we
get less 7 actually keep that 7 is the one mark of the is down in lung tumors that care for children with less mutations. So in fact, that isn't so crazy an idea to be able to nail to the less 7 replacement.
So the last question is maybe a short answer from all of you. How rapidly is treatment changing as a result of these advances in research?
That's a great question.
It's probably nothing to do with it, but in changing evolution. For a long time, all of the normal science, human and everything, suddenly changing. But, you know, tamoxifen was a huge change, okay, in breast cancer. Massive difference. The next big thing was chemotherapy, CNF, big change. All the changes in CNF are essentially moving around the regions. They're not really changing. The center is the next big change. I think many people think they're meant to be changing to making small ones in the therapies because they don't rely on specific targets. They simply, the targets are generated by the tumor in the global region. I think, I think that's where the basis is so critical. You never actually know where the success is going. No one is smart enough to know where these things are going. You just need a lot of very clever people working very hard, funded by the agencies that we're going to do this kind of work. And sure enough, there'll be something good for that. That I can understand.
Mr.
Wilson
cited the my research on hereditary breast cancer has led me to ovarian cancer, and that's where I spend most of my time. So I spend most of my research time in studying ovarian cancer or hereditary non-hereditary forms, simply because the disease is lethal. More than 75% of women who are diagnosed with the disease last. They don't last 35 years. It's a very difficult disease. It's almost intractable. But recent evidence, recent studies have shown that specific drugs which take advantage of these DNA repair pathways that I was talking about, that these particular genes are involved in, BRCA1, BRCA2, okay, have shown incredible promise. So women who have ovarian cancers that have mutations that affect these BRCA1 genes in particular are very have turned out to be quite responsive to drugs. These types of drugs are called PARP inhibitors. So I'm not going to go into the explanation, but it takes advantage of the molecular pathways that have been affected
drugs also seem to be showing some promise in women with ovarian cancer that don't necessarily will not inherit mutation. That's what I see in the future. And I'm hoping that some of these drugs are going to be useful in Canada so that we can treat women with this devastating disease with these drugs so that they can survive certainly much longer and hopefully will develop new cures in the future.
I'm on the basic side of the cancer research spectrum. And I often get discussions saying, well, we seem to look always for something. When will we read the books? I want to be very clear that, you know, misconception about discovery, right? It's very, Bill actually mentioned it here. It's the serendipitous aspect. It's really difficult to force a discovery with a breakthrough if you don't know what's going to do. So you kind of evolve around the problem, and you keep your eyes open, your ears open, and you know, you keep digging the best science possible, and eventually you see something that matters without you. You didn't discover. It's a discovery. So you didn't know it was there in the first place. Even if you were to force to concentrate as hard as you could onto one specific aspect, maybe that the answer is not there. So it's really difficult to anticipate how, where, and when those discoveries happen. And that's why it's important to keep an open mind and have a milestone for research and perform as good as possible, as great research as possible with an open mind. But it's really difficult to anticipate where the tools are working. It's important also to keep in mind that you use the analogy of the tree, right? You want to leave the fruits, you need to be careful. And it takes a while, actually. It takes a lot of care, it takes a lot of support, and it takes time. And being a basic researcher, we're not less motivated to find an answer disease answer. We have family too, and one out of three family members have cancer, have family members died from cancer. We all know about this, and we're all fully dedicated. So all I can tell you is that we use the best tools possible. And we need to, of course, talk to the clinic and use the best tools possible to keep it as efficient as possible. But I think it's part of it is hope, and another part of it is to get the information that orient and therapy is as fast as possible, as well as possible, but as efficient as possible.
And to make sure that the support that we have from the public, such as you, is transmitted back to you and giving information about what we find, where we are, what we need, and how much we appreciate your support. Thank you very much for attending. I'd like to thank the volunteers who contributed to the registration desk and the food and helping out. Annette Novak is floating around somewhere. Thank you, Annette. The next point.